release of the first hostages in the Israel-Hamas deal will be delayed at least a day, according to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's national security advisor. And at the UN, officials briefed the Security Council Wednesday on the humanitarian crisis faced by women and children in Gaza, while calling for the ceasefire to be extended beyond the original 4 days.
And over the coming weeks, we will work to reunite all hostages with their families, every single one.
Today is Thursday, November 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Tsahi Hanegbi, head of the National Security Council of Israel, said Wednesday that the contacts on the release of the hostages are advancing and continuing constantly. The start of the release will take place according to the original agreement between the sides, but not before Friday. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu held a press briefing on Wednesday. VOA's Kim Lewis has this report.
Israel and Hamas agreed on Wednesday to a ceasefire in Gaza for at least 4 days to let in aid and free at least 50 hostages held by militants in the Palestinian enclave in exchange for at least 150 Palestinians jailed in Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said during a briefing on Wednesday that the Red Cross would be allowed to visit the remaining hostages in Gaza. He says the outline that was agreed upon will not include releasing murderers. It does include the representatives of the Red Cross, visits from the Red Cross to the hostages, and giving them medications. Here is the exact segment of the agreement. The Red Cross will be allowed to visit the remainder of the hostages and to give them required medications, and I expect the Red Cross to do its work. He also said Israel was winning and would continue the war until it achieved complete victory. Kim Lewis, VOA News.
My colleague Kim Lewis spoke with Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem for reaction to the agreement between Israel and Hamas.
Linda, thank you for joining me today. What has been reaction to this hostage agreement?
I think there's kind of mixed feelings. Look, on one hand, the hostages have kind of captured everybody's attention and everybody's hearts in Israel. You know, the thought of these children, little children who've been held in Hamas captivity for almost 7 weeks is sort of almost unbearable. And the fact that 50 of them will be released, I think, you know, gives everybody kind of a ray of hope. At the same time, you know, there's concern about what the price is for that hostage release and whether Israel will be able to, as it says, go back to fighting Hamas when the ceasefire is over.
And also, once the hostages are released, can you tell us what the process is when they're released?
Yes, women and children. They'll be released in four different groups, 12 or 13 each one, and over the 4 days. And they'll be given to the Red Cross. Hamas will give them to the Red Cross. And the Red Cross will probably take them to the Israeli border and hand them to Israeli soldiers. They will then be taken to medical facilities in Israel that are prepared to receive them, where their families will be waiting for them. There's special teams of doctors and trauma specialists and all kinds of things. And they're going to be kept away from the public. Israel doesn't want a repeat of what happened when one of the elderly hostages was released and said she was well treated and that her captors were nice to her. So as journalists, it's going to be not very easy to get to the hostages. They will have medical checks. And then, you know, if they're not young children, in the next few days, they'll have a debriefing with, you know, Israeli officials and also hopefully to provide intelligence about where the other hostages might be being held.
And also, you brought up a really good point about how the hostages are being treated while in captivity. Some analysts say that hostages may be told by Hamas to tell the world how good they were treated. And the hostages may do this, given they may still have family being held in captivity by Hamas and may be fearful of what would happen to them. So this is a possibility that this could happen.
Right. There is a possibility that that will happen. And of course, we know that when Hamas came into Israel and killed 1,200 people and their apparently rape and all kinds of other things, that said, they were apparently handed over to other Hamas gunmen. There's a special unit in Hamas that deals with hostages. It's possible that they were not maltreated or attacked or tortured. They certainly were while they were captured, but once they were there. But I do agree with you. You know, there's also whole families were captured. And since only women and children are being released, at least at this time, it's going to be very hard. I was even thinking there's a 3.5-year-old girl who was captured by herself. Her entire family was killed by Hamas. And, you know, somebody's been taking care of her and she's become attached to somebody. And what if that person is not released in this hostage release? Then this poor little girl, her name is Abigail, is going to be, you know, going through separation anxiety yet again. So it's just really hard to fathom. At the same time, for the families who have been waiting and waiting, it's going to be a very special day. And of course, they're obviously very concerned. And I'm sure they're concerned about long-time trauma and all kinds of other things.
That was Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis. UN officials Wednesday briefed the Security Council on the humanitarian crisis faced by women and children in Gaza, while calling for a ceasefire to be extended beyond the original 4 days. Linda Thomas Greenfield, United States Ambassador to the United Nations, had this to say at the meeting.
The deal was reached to secure the release of at least 50 hostages, including Americans, taken by Hamas during its brutal terrorist assault against Israel. And over the coming weeks, we will work to reunite all hostages with their families, every single one. We also appreciate the commitment that Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government have made to support an extended pause to ensure this deal can be fully carried out, to ensure the provisions of additional humanitarian assistance to help alleviate the suffering of innocent Palestinian families in Gaza, and to allow time for Palestinian civilians to move to safer locations.
That was Linda Thomas Greenfield, United States Ambassador to the United Nations. Authorities say a vehicle speeding toward a U.S.-Canada bridge from the American side crashed and exploded Wednesday at a checkpoint near Niagara Falls, killing 2 people. AP correspondent Julie Walker has this report.
According to the official speaking on condition of anonymity, the 2 people were found dead in that vehicle, which exploded before noon at a checkpoint on the American side of the Rainbow Bridge in Niagara Falls. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
This is obviously a very serious situation.
He made a brief statement in Parliament as news came in.
We are following up to try and get as many answers as rapidly as possible. We are in close contact with U.S. officials.
President Biden says he's been briefed. The FBI and ATF say they're investigating the blast. Photos and video on social media show thick smoke, flames, and a damaged security booth with debris surrounding it. Julie Walker, New York.
The explosion prompted the closing of 4 border crossings in the area. Melissa Raffalo says in an AP interview that she was in Niagara Falls State Park and saw the aftermath of the vehicle explosion.
We saw a huge plume of black smoke rising from around the border checkpoint area. And then we kept walking. We got into our car. And then the police directed us away.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul says that there is no indication of a terrorist attack in the crash and explosion. We're following these stories from around the world. Dutch voters cast their ballots on Wednesday in a nail-biting election. Exit polls showed anti-Islam firebrand Geert Wilders' Party for Freedom finished ahead and will lead talks to form a coalition government. Iran has barred some of the UN nuclear watchdog's most experienced and expert inspectors from operating there, something the IAEA said is a very serious blow to its work. The watchdog said that while Iran is allowed to do that, the way it was done was unprecedented and harmful to its work. VOA's International Edition continues. I am Rick Pantaleo. U.S. President Joe Biden highlighted on Tuesday his administration's efforts to halt the flow of fentanyl and the ingredients used to produce the deadly drug, following deals with leaders of China and Mexico made last week at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Meeting in San Francisco. However, observers say past efforts to control production and export from outside of the country have proved ineffective. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Swara has this report.
The deadly drug fentanyl can be shipped undetected via airport cargo, border crossings, and even through the postal system. Following counter-narcotics deals with China and Mexico reached on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in San Francisco last week, on Tuesday, President Joe Biden vowed to boost his administration's efforts to combat the drug that has killed more than 200,000 Americans in recent years.
But this challenge also has roots outside our borders, outside the borders of the United States. It's a global challenge that demands global action.
Fentanyl is mass-produced in Mexico using precursor chemicals largely from China and trafficked via cartels into the U.S. While China has agreed to reduce the flow of precursor chemicals, implementation remains to be seen and other sources may open up. Peter Reuter, professor in the Department of Criminology at the University of Maryland, via Skype.
We always worry about displacement. That is, that if China stops sending the precursors, that the very large, poorly regulated, corruptly regulated Indian industry will replace China.
Experts praise Biden's comprehensive approach, but say that a heavy focus on limiting fentanyl's entry can be counterproductive to the positive steps in harm reduction the administration has taken. Brandon Marshall, professor of epidemiology at the Brown University School of Public Health, via Skype.
Many of these efforts to restrict the supply lead traffickers to identify substances which are more potent. So that means a smaller quantity for the same effect, which are easier to traffic.
Biden urged Congress to tighten laws to make fentanyl a Schedule I drug, but advocates say such a move is dangerous. Mary Silla, Director of Overdose Prevention Policy and Strategy at the National Harm Reduction Coalition, via Skype.
Maintaining the scheduling of fentanyl as Schedule I means that people are going to be stigmatized, people are going to go to jail and prison and actually get pulled out of their communities and be more likely to overdose.
Silla argued that more focus and resources should be placed instead on efforts to reduce the negative impacts of substance use, including syringe services, overdose prevention, and drug treatments. Patsy Wirakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
As Ukraine's forces continue their counteroffensive, mines and explosives threaten its people in deoccupied regions. According to the Ukrainian government, since the start of the Russian invasion, mines have killed at least 264 civilians and injured more than 830. Demining efforts, led by various entities, are actively underway. VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gungadze tells the story.
On Saturday morning, the mining crew in Balaklia, Ukraine's Kharkiv region, are getting ready to go to the field. Russian forces had occupied one-third of this region shortly after the start of the war. When they retreated months later, they left this land contaminated with mines. Such weapons have killed at least 264 civilians and injured more than 830 throughout Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022. Emergency personnel here face an unprecedented test, says Anatoly Vrublevsky, the head of the Kharkiv region's demining directorate and overseer of 35 demining units.
The biggest problem is that almost every day, actually every day, people die or get injured. We're talking about the Oblast here, 30% of which was occupied. Then, after a counteroffensive operation, it was liberated, and we have very dangerous territory to work on.
Rublevsky says international support is crucial to their work. Ukrainian deminers make use of all outside assistance, which includes demining machines, protective gear, and transportation. Here in Balaklia, emergency services detect a mine and conduct a controlled explosion. Back in Kyiv, the Ukrainian government coordinates the humanitarian demining effort, bringing together government stakeholders and international partners. Deputy Minister of Economy Igor Beskorovany oversees the initiative, which for him is personal. In 2016, he lost his leg to an anti-tank mine.
We want return to using 80% potentially contaminated area.
Beskorovany says Russia violated all norms and practices when it mined the territory, and this poses a significant challenge for the miners. Ukrainian specialists are working on techniques to scan potentially contaminated areas to create a database and map for future demining effort.
We have situation when territories that contamination have any logic. It's a huge problem because we can predict next step when we're working with logic, but we can't predict the next step when we're working with situations that don't have any logic.
Last spring, the World Bank estimated that Ukraine would require $37.5 billion for the mining efforts. However, the need continues to evolve with the war and requires constant reevaluation. Lithuania is spearheading the European Union's demining efforts in Ukraine. Tomas Matulevičius, the economic attaché of the Lithuanian embassy in Ukraine, says the international coalition must do more.
It's not enough for the moment, but it's just the beginning. And in the future, we hope that it will be more tools, more methods, more financial instruments, and the more, I would say, funds or the government will join the coalition.
The demining of Ukraine could take from 10 to 100 years, he said.
It depends how much money it will be, how much specialists will be prepared here in Ukraine and abroad. So it depends from all us, and we need to do that together.
The unprecedented contamination of Ukrainian land with mines and other explosives, destroying ecosystem and undermining food security in Ukraine and the world, deepening the problem of hunger. Depending on the resources, it can take decades for Ukraine to clean its land, and it will rely on international community to assist with the demining effort. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Balaklia, Kharkiv region, Ukraine.
Kenya's health ministry has rolled out a digital health information system to help workers diagnose patients and store their health records. Mohammed Yusuf reports from a village in western Kenya, where hospitals have recorded an increase in people seeking medical assistance since the deployment of the system.
Mildred Owegi is one of 3,000 community health promoters in Kisumu County in western Kenya. Owegi, who has been doing this work for 30 years, recently started using a digital health information system on the job. A phone app allows her to diagnose diseases before administering medication and to know when to advise people to visit a health facility.
Because normally we are using these handouts. We are just using handouts. And the phone is good because the phone is directing you on what to do. So you can do what the phone is telling you, so you can do the right thing.
Lillian Okello, a mother of twins, is embracing the new system.
I like the digital way of taking the health data of the children because when they always come, I always see them just reading what is in their phone and doing exactly what they're supposed to do compared to the manual one.
Kenya launched the digital health information system last month, providing smartphones to 100,000 health workers nationwide with the goal of improving the quality of healthcare. Health experts say the system could push Kenya closer to universal health coverage, ensuring people can access healthcare services anytime and anywhere. In the past few weeks, in this hospital in Kisumu County, the number of patients seeking medical services has increased from 700 to 1,800. Richard Adede is a clinical officer at Nyangande Hospital.
The number of patients has increased a lot. More so, again, the guys who have achieved a lot in terms of the digitalization of HIV clans and TB clans, because we can detect them early, we call them a day before, and they come.
The local government says the deployment of electronic system allows it to plan for the healthcare needs of the people. John Seda is a Kisumu County Community Health Service Coordinator.
So we don't have to look for data because it is within a touch, and we can use it to make a project
what we might have. For example, we can say that next year we're expecting this number of deliveries. Next year, this year we expect to consume this amount of commodities. This year, these are our baseline mobility levels. So we expect next year we need to prepare for a similar or something higher or lesser.
The project still faces hurdles such as the lack of reliable data networks in some areas. For now, health workers are advised to seek places with good connectivity when helping people in need. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Kolal, Kenya.
This is Science in a Minute.
The James Webb Space Telescope has captured new high-resolution images of one of the most dazzling objects in the cosmos, called the Crab Nebula. The Crab Nebula actually contains bright remnants of a spectacular supernova that exploded and was captured by Japanese and Chinese astronomers in the year 1054. The Crab Nebula is located about 6,500 light-years away in the constellation Taurus and has long fascinated scientists who are trying to learn about the origins, environments, actions, and effects of the supernovae phenomena. As telescope technology developed over the years, images of the nebula became more spectacular, especially with recent observations made with the Hubble and now James Webb Space Telescopes. The new JWST images captured in infrared light reveals additional and detailed aspects of the inner workings of the Crab Nebula. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The fourth Thursday in November is Thanksgiving in the United States, a national holiday celebrating the first anniversary of the establishment of one of the earliest permanent English colonies in North America. On November 11, 1620, the ship Mayflower, carrying 102 settlers who came to be known as Pilgrims, arrived at the shores of North America. They were the first of a group of religious separatists who refused to follow the teachings of the Church of England, a punishable offense in their native country. So they made the decision to leave Europe and establish a farming village in the northern part of the Virginia colony, which had been settled 13 years earlier. Accidentally landing nearly 1,000 kilometers too far north, they nevertheless decided to stay, finally settling on a spot a little south of today's city of Boston in the state of Massachusetts. There they founded Plymouth Colony. That first year in North America was very difficult. Although they were not starving, thanks in part to support from the local native population of the Wampanoag people, within the first 2 months, two-thirds of them died. But the fall of 1621 brought plentiful crops. And as the end of the harvest coincided with the anniversary of their arrival in North America, the Pilgrims celebrated. 53 settlers sat down to a feast with 90 of their Wampanoag neighbors, dining on wild fowl, venison, and a variety of vegetables. But first came heartfelt prayers, thanking God for his forbearance, which allowed them to survive. This American spirit of gratitude dates back to our earliest days, when the Pilgrims celebrated a successful first harvest, thanks to the generosity and support of the Wampanoag people, said President Joe Biden. It inspired George Washington to give his troops a day of prayer and thanks amid fierce fighting for American independence. It also moved Abraham Lincoln to proclaim Thanksgiving a national holiday, honoring America's bounty and asking God to bring us together to care for one another and heal our nation. Today, Thanksgiving is still all about family and food. Holiday dinner still features autumn vegetables, but instead of venison and wild fowl, the feast centers on a roasted turkey. This Thanksgiving, as homes across America fill with laughter, favorite family foods, and the joy of friends and relatives reuniting, said President Biden, we give thanks for everything that is good in our lives and reflect on the many blessings of our nation.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.